Hello, my name is Kirsti Malterud. I'm a Norwegian medical doctor. I'm living in Bergen, and we're in Bergen today. I'm 60 years old. I'm trained as a general practitioner, and I've also for many years been a professor of general practice here in Bergen. My research has mainly been on questions beyond lesbian health, but my research has also some relevance for lesbian health research, and I've also, especially the last years, been doing and perhaps especially supervising research on lesbian health and health services to lesbian women. I would also tell that I'm a lesbian myself. I was one of the founders of a public health service for gays and lesbians in Oslo, actually in the mid-70s, so that's a long time ago. That was a pioneer thing, and we were lucky to have strong support from the healthcare authorities in Oslo at that time. From doing that kind of work, I found that health problems and healthcare for gays and lesbians, and for me especially, lesbian health has been my focus, is actually not so very different from healthcare and health problems for other people. My research has mainly been on women's health problems, medically unexplained disorders, and on the understanding of what's health, what's disease, and on the way the medical system encounters what they do not understand or what we do not understand. I've been doing research on patient perspectives for a lot of different chronic conditions. But on the lesbian health research issue, I did some small register studies many years ago in the early 80s. Counting up numbers from our healthcare service, telling what kind of problems did we see and how many. Not very important, but kind of awareness raising on which were the specific problems and how could these problems later on be better solved by the ordinary healthcare system, which would be normal in Norway.
What are those problems, if you may?
At that time, it was clear discrimination issues. It was questions about how to get out of the closet. It was psychological problems. It was how to discuss the situation with my parents. It was, am I really a lesbian or am I not? Is this just something which will pass on? These kind of questions. Will I need some therapy to change? Is there some therapy available for that? And we always answered, it's better you stay on being yourself.
Could you tell me what was the general understanding from the medical establishment and perhaps also from the establishment of psychology about homosexuality at the time when you were doing this work?
At that time, which is now about 30 years ago, homosexuality was much more pathologized still than it is now. In medicine, there were strong opinions about development problems, identity problems, about seeing gay and lesbian people as some inherent big trouble. And I was also at that time connected to a team working on transsexuality on a national level in Norway, which was at that time considered as something very special, very fascinating, and we felt important to work on that, but it was actually very medicalizing. Come to us and we'll help you fix it. Since then, there is not any more so strong focus from medicine on pathology. The problems now is more on the one hand, rejecting that there are some problems because we come so far and we have the partner law, and Norway is the country of equality, and why should we discuss problems at all, which is, I would say, neglecting some of the specific problems. But on the other hand, it's, oh, fascinating, oh, since you're depressed and you're lesbian, that's certainly the explanation, and some kind of over-focusing the sexual thing. So the last years I've been more involved in questions on what could be the best healthcare for lesbian women, or which are the problems when lesbians meet healthcare, or which are the problems in how medicine consider being lesbian.
Could you outline to me the what changed from the 70s to now? I mean, you've already mentioned what changed, but in other words, what was the platform that facilitated that change? What did it come from, the work, political work? Did it come from work within the medical institution? Did it come from work from LGBT activists rejecting medicalization, or?
I would say mostly from the LGBT activists. The associations have been most important, pushing a general political change of attitudes in Norway very strongly. And I also would say that the work we did related to the health service we established in Oslo, it was not only about seeing people in trouble, but it was going out informing institutions of education, institutions of treatment. We were to hospitals, we were to prisons. I think I for a couple of years I did 40 presentations around on important institutions in Oslo, mainly presenting a few facts and something more about attitude. Because at that time, discrimination was really an issue.
And what was the background for the 70s? In other words, in the years before, what was the general concern regarding these issues from the medical establishment, say the 50s, 40s, 60s, and so on?
This is a disease, you would need treatment, we might help you. It's a pity you have this problem, but we can help you change.
So when is homosexuality removed from the list of pathologies?
I think the year of that, there is no specific Norwegian list, but the important year for that in Norway was, I think, 1977, when the Norwegian Psychiatric Association concluded, after a very strong discussion, that we should not put pathology on this. However, many, many years later on, Norwegian psychiatrists and psychologists still regarded it as a developmental problem, but the conclusion at that meeting made a strong impact on professional attitudes.
So, in other words, it seems to me that you're suggesting that there has been, since early on, a kind of tragic understanding of homosexuality as a kind of, first as a kind of disease, second as a kind of lack of fortune.
Yes.
How is that situation today, and how do you position yourself in regards to this narrative, if you will?
Well, myself, coming out in the 70s and being happy enough to be on when the movements were strong, I found myself in this context as being very lucky, because I was born at a time where this was what I came out to. I came out to a community, a strong community, a strong and proud community, which also helped me a lot as a professional to mediate what I thought about homosexuality and health. Since then, the discussions on is this something you are born with, or did you create it, or all that kind of things has developed. And I think that that's broadens the vision, although in the ordinary population, I still, in Norway, you still find a lot of people who would be reluctant to homosexuality unless when they can declare, but it's an inborn error and I can't blame you. So still you find in the ordinary population a lot of people, and also among perhaps young homosexuals and their parents, some sad support in thinking it's inevitable, you can't do anything, that's how it is. For myself, I think that things can change in a life. It's very good that we are not in the very dichotomous or trichotomous divisions which have been ruling for such a long time.
Can you explain that, the dichotomous and trichotomous divisions?
When I came out in the 70s in Norway, I had a very clear feeling that you'll have to choose. If you go for that lesbian line, there is no return. Okay, I found out that that was where I had to go, and so there would be no return for me. And also we thought at that time that people who call themselves bisexuals, they were not brave enough, or they would have to make some guarantees both ways, but really at that time you were either one or the other. So when I say dichotomous, that's about people are born like that and you put them there or they are there, and at some time in their life they will sooner or later find out what they really are. Since then my own views have broadened very much, and also because I've been married for many years to a woman who was previously married to a man, and that was no mistake of hers. So these life experiences of my own has come to me in the same period when we understood much more about how identity and sexuality is developed. When I said trichotomy, it's almost the same, but then putting in the bi concept in the middle. Either you're homo, bi, or hetero, which I don't think is a useful conceptualization. Although in real life, of course, I live a lesbian life. I consider myself as lesbian, and I couldn't throw away the categories, although people might move during their lives.
So you're suggesting that there should be, or you have gained a kind of understanding of a sexuality that is more diverse and
much more fluent and more dependent on what happens and what creates windows of opportunity or closes the windows of opportunity, and yeah, like that.
But this I would say, without having previous knowledge, would be an understanding that goes against the kind of medical established understanding of sexuality.
Not necessarily. No, I think that's moving in Scandinavia, at least. I think that although you find old-fashioned doctors or psychologists or psychiatrists sitting there clinging to the old concepts, I think a lot of people know some people. A lot of professionals, not only in their professional heads, but in their everyday life, they know some people. They know that things are changing. So also professional conceptualization is changing. But we're not at the end of that road, but we're on the road, for sure.
So How is gay, lesbian, transsexual, bisexual health different from heterosexual, transsexual health?
Whose opinions would you like me to express
them? So I think two. One, the mainstream, and two, the one that you have applied in your research about lesbian women.
Okay. Well, I'll start with the first, because that's more easy, and you could think comparative on that. In my research on lesbian women, my point of departure has always been this is not a tragedy. Then why consider it as a health problem by itself? Just to mention a few examples, I'm now supporting a master's students on a study where lesbian women present their experiences of the health promoting aspects of a lesbian life, which I think would not shock but perhaps make a change in the minds of Norwegian doctors. It has been accepted now for publication in the Journal of the Norwegian Medical Association.
Can you expand on that?
Yes. Our preconception was that although some lesbian women have clear health problems related to sexual orientation and identity, perhaps most lesbian women have good health, are happy about being lesbian, could there be aspects of the specific lesbian life which perhaps protected you against some health problems which you would encounter if you were not lesbian? So this is a focus group study where we asked happy lesbians to explain the potentially health promoting experiences they had, such as freedom from narrow structures. Me and my partner, we can decide our roles. Freedom from how to perform yourself. Okay, I don't have to use these terrible shoes. I'll use my boots instead, that's more comfortable, and I don't have to because I'm not on that market where this would not be a nice thing. And getting through some level of trouble by coming out, I've gained something, I feel stronger, I know something about finding myself. I have found some important aspects of identity which I will never let go, which can also be applied on other aspects of my life. That's examples of what we found in that study.
May I ask you a question in parentheses?
Yes.
When you're speaking about health, are we speaking about mental and physical health?
Yeah.
Both.
Certainly, yes. I can't think of these apart.
Okay.
I'll move to another example. Back to the first example. That research project came up as an opposition to all the tragedy. We had in the years before that some reports about how terrible things were, reports which you have probably more from in your material about suicide narratives, about a destiny which you can never escape, that kind of things, and also especially a big statistical report on bad health and suicidal behavior among homosexuals and lesbians. And my point was there is a need for some other voices, because these tragedy voices, although being researched, it can support itself and create a reality just by being told and told and told again. The other example is a PhD study which I'm also supporting as a supervisor, which is about what's the important things when lesbians seek healthcare. And that study came up as an opposition to claims that there would be an increased prevalence or risk of this and this and this and this disease in lesbian women, such as mama cancer, such as drug abuse, such as depression, which of course there might be, but the support for that on an evidence base is very loose. So there are myths on lesbian women as a specific group needing specific attention on their specific risk of specific disorders. Reading the literature on this, we found that there was rather a need in the healthcare system when encountering lesbian patients to be aware of the specific personal needs of the lesbian women, rather than as if there should be some medical needs. You can't split these, but lesbian women complained of not being seen, not being heard, of being taken as heterosexual just by default. This study is about when is it important for the lesbian women that her general practitioner or family physician knows about her sexual identity, and when is it not important? What's the impact of it? Which difference does it make? Which came up as the most important point on what's on the specific needs for lesbians in healthcare.
Could you name a few cases in which it is important and which it isn't, according to your research?
A woman lost her partner by death. She became a widow. Her doctor did not know that she had been married to a woman. In that case, it was very important that for this woman seeing her doctor and telling about the death, that this was not only about her friend, but actually her darling, her closest partner ever. That's one thing. Another thing, for certain gynecological things, and the doctors just started talking and talking as if their partner was a man. The women said, if the doctor knew that my partner is a woman, the conversation would be much easier for both of us. So this study is about when is it important and when is it not? How can doctors ask, and which kind of responses could they expect? Another part of this study is about healthcare experiences. How are lesbian women met when they see doctors? And there, from that study, it's the broad range I started by describing, from perfectly fine relationships and events where the doctor had an awareness for what was important and saw them as full persons, and on the other hand, bluntly provocative discriminations, doctors doing pelvic examinations, fascinated by talking about whom this woman was in bed with yesterday, like this. So we found actually a quite broad range of specific knowledge needed by the doctor, awareness on heteronormativity and the need of breaking that, and also on opening the window for the woman to be herself when she came there.
Is there some specific law or legislation in place to prevent this type of discrimination from occurring in medical practice?
Not especially. We have a law on discrimination, but that is on a much higher level. I was actually in the group preparing for that law, and that was, I think, 20 years ago now. But that law has almost never been used. It's there more like a preventive measure than a measure for action, and it was more meant for discrimination on on housing and work and that kind of things. But of course there are ethical rules, there are rules of behavior in medical encounters, but not specifically on sexual orientation. No, there is one rule, one regulation I could mention, which is about quality in healthcare. And quality in healthcare should be professionally sufficient, which means evidence-based and that kind of thing. And it should be care, taking care, it should be considerate. So in these in the worst of the cases we found in the study, which tells that there is still something to do, these regulations could have been applied because this was not very considerate attitudes.
And what would be the case of, pardon me if I sound ignorant, but two cases in which sexual orientation and gender identity would be blurred and have a much more defined problematic medical attitude, which would be transsexuality and intersexuality. How would these two subjects be protected from issues of discrimination and mistreatment?
No special regulation.
So there's no regulation?
No.
And are there accounts of the way that these two types of subjects are treated within medical practice?
I've been following with special interest, especially the intersex case, because it's been so completely silent. It is as if in Norway any child is born as a boy or a girl. And the last few years we've heard about what happens at the clinics when intersex babies are born, and this is not out in the open. It's interesting that all the discussions on that are going on in a closed medical room, as if there are no political aspects, as if there are no ethical aspects on that. So as in other countries, where in doubt, they just change it, thinking that this would be the best for the child, and we never hear about it.
So there is no consent from the family in Norway?
I think yes, there must be consent from the family, but parents would certainly be convinced by the doctor giving them advice. I don't know of concrete cases on that. On transsexuality, there has been a lot of discussions on service opportunities, and I think these service opportunities have become better the last years, but I've not followed that as closely.
What do you mean by service opportunity?
Who could help? Is there help to be given? Is there a system for assessment? And if people are assessed for change, is there a service to do that and for follow up? There has been complaints about lack of availability on that.
Returning to the issue of intersexuality, I just recently encountered a really fascinating film that touches on the case of an intersexual person that and the parents reject the medical decision to operate. They move to a different place, and they allow, but they give the child hormones, so she starts to develop more feminine.
I think I saw the same. You remember
XXY?
Yes, okay. Yes.
But the reason I'm bringing this up is because there is a moment in the film that in which the father asks the girl in the car that eventually, or tells her that eventually she will have the right to decide.
Yeah.
Right. And to me, that was the most critical part of the film. She says, but why do I have to decide?
Right.
My question is, I know this is a fiction, but my question is actually medical. Could that be so? I mean, do you have to make a decision? And take the hormone or take the testosterone and so on? Or could you just live a normal life without any medical assistance in that regard?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's the most important question, because why couldn't she just be herself?
Exactly.
Why, yes, why push her in this or that direction? And so far, I think in Norway it would be utopian to say, or I don't think parents, Norwegian parents, would say, let's wait and see. I don't think Norwegian doctors would support parents in wait and see. But I don't know.
But is that a cultural decision, or is that a medical decision, or is it both?
Both, because the authority of the medical advice, I think, would be very, very strong, too strong perhaps. And I don't think the medical experts in that field, I don't actually think they are very reflected on gender, unfortunately, on gender as construction, and especially on the cultural construction of gender. So for myself, having worked for many years ago in the service on transgender, which was, I think, somehow surgical, a surgical view on gender, I would so much prefer a society where this woman in the car, this girl in the car, would be, where her voice would be listened to, and where, okay, let her be herself, and don't let her parents have a need to protect her from all the terrible things which will happen if they don't take the decision for her. So I think there is some tensions on the the transgender community's work for getting services to change compared to a society where this kind of change would not be necessary. Actually, I'm not sure I believe in the idea that I'm really a woman, or I'm really, after all, a man, and that's where I would need you to take me. Because couldn't we have I'm really me and being accepted for that?
Right. There is a performance artist in New York that has rejected to classify him or herself in gender,
yes,
terms. So he or she goes around with a, you know, he has a long beard, but she also has breasts, and
yes,
she or he is always perceived as a kind of freak. I mean, is this,
yes,
this image,
yes,
of the freak?
And that's what parents, of course, want to protect their children from. But this person, and I've heard about similar performances, actually they at least, if they don't make it ridiculous to be in between, they do a very important political work, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
So if I understand correctly, what you're suggesting is to define in different ways a positive thinking in relationship to health, to reject and the negativist paradigm that we've been living.
Yes,
yes.
And that connects closely to the other part of my research, my general practice research, where I've been for many years collaborating with a Danish colleague on a project where we wanted to shift attention from risk to resources in medicine.
Can
because,
you explain that?
Yes. We became increasingly worried that all medicine was focusing what was what was wrong with people. We read the Israeli sociologist Antonovsky, who wrote about salutogenesis, where his point is, it is more interesting what keeps people healthy than what makes them ill. because there is a balance here, and you become ill when the resources are not sufficiently strong. So why don't we focus on what keep people healthy instead of just looking at what was them down? So we have for years worked on resources, not as an alternative, but as a complement to the pathogenetic view in medicine. And that's not very original. There is a lot of medical research focusing salutogenesis, and we have done it especially compared to the risk focusing attention in medicine. You can be protected from even from death if you're sufficiently risk focused, or the belief that any disease can be prevented. We think that's hiding the possibilities of promoting health. And from that point, I thought that of course gay and lesbian people have problems, and some of them are specifically related to sexual identity, sexual orientation. I wouldn't neglect that, and I would not dismiss that problem. But thinking about health, why don't we rather develop knowledge about how health can be created, developed, supported in a lesbian life? So I moved my views from the other research to the gay and lesbian research, and that came up especially after report on the terrible health, which I couldn't, it didn't match my view of my world, even if I saw it from my doctor's office. I couldn't believe that that was the terrible life of most of my gay and lesbian colleagues.
I imagine that this is something that you practice literally in your medical practice. But how is your work received at large from the community?
By the gay and lesbian community, there has been a lot of opposition. And I put this in a political framework because it's convenient for funding and attention that gay and lesbians are regarded as people with problems. So the Norwegian report, which was released 10 years ago, also released a lot of funding, but funding on the problems. Some activists and some part of the organizations, I met a lot of opposition because they said I neglected the problems, and they said that I didn't understand how difficult it was. I knew very well how difficult it was. I had been working on this special service for many years, but I also saw that we could reinforce problems by just focusing problems. That's kind of the social construction of tragedy. And I knew from my own practice that knowledge about resources could help people cope. So I met very strong reactions from the gay and lesbian community. And for many years, I felt very much alone as a researcher or as an academic person within this field, assessing the evidence, which I'm very capable of. I know how to read a paper, and I know how to judge the statistical quality of a paper. And actually, a lot of these prevalence studies about the tragedy were academic rubbish.
So it was a political rejection, in other
words.
Yes,
clearly. But most of my research has also been driven by political motivations, although I use the tools, I follow the rules. But my motivation is clearly, I want to contribute to change.
But that political rejection influenced the way that heterosexual communities would view and read your work?
Well, yes, I think in that way, and on the questions of lesbian health, we've not published so much so far, but actually reactions from the professional community, they are very good, because my colleagues want to know what to do. They want to know how they could improve. They want to know how special group of patients would need some special. So providing some insight and some tools on that, that has been very well received, I think, so far.
Something that interests me is that in different conversations, it has come up in my interviews that there is a kind of homonormative discourse in Norway. In the sense that there is, for example, with Ellen Mortensen, she was discussing the fact that that she doesn't think that queer studies mm-hmm. has never really flourished in Norway, in the sense that it was also politically rejected by the gay and lesbian activists.
Mm.
Understanding of a queer identity as opposed to a very specifically defined gay or lesbian identity mm. is something that could hinder the political quest as opposed to help it.
Yeah.
And that's, you seem to be echoing within a different field a similar kind of opposition to a kind of queering of medicine, if you will.
I don't see clearly your parallel, but I could follow on the question of queer theory,
yes.
which I've also, by the way, been for 7 years professor of feminist studies in medicine.
Okay.
And that was just at the time when queer studies and queer theory was presented. I think there is a tension, which I can understand, because queer theory is very theoretically challenging. It's interesting, it broadens my mind, and it gets very close to the movie we talked about, and the girl in the car. Why categories would destroy her life, so why do we cling to these categories? At the same time, for me, being a medical practitioner, living in the world, living my own lesbian life, I couldn't escape from categories. I feel almost every day, although I'm 60 years today, very confident in my lesbian identity, I feel challenges almost every day on being a lesbian. Of course I can pretend that I escape all categories and say that I am a kind of person who for some years lived with another person who called herself a woman, and well, there is a tension between the theoretical aspects and the applicability of queer theory. And also, I think Ellen Mortensen is right that especially the organizations have clinged to the dichotomous versions for political purposes, for funding purposes, for being seen. And also because I agree to the objection that queer theory somehow makes discrimination a more subtle thing, and it's some kind of luxury diving into the queer theory, which of course can be applied to escape from the political problems of oppression, which is still here, although I've told you a lot about things becoming more equalized. So to me, I would, in medicine, I would not make the homosexual or the lesbian thing a very strong and broad label. I would say, when is this important? It is important in this case, and in the other cases it's not important at all. Then other categories are superior or more strong when we're asking about health and health problems. So I think I have been opposing a view that this is the lesbian patient, And this lesbian patient is completely different from the heterosexual woman patient in this and this aspects. I think maybe the similarities are much larger, but there are some specific things which the doctor should know about.
A kind of silly question. What would be the ideal application to your work, to your research, if you lived in a place in which...
That's not a silly question, not at all, no. Well, the best gift you could give me as a response to my research would be that there would be no need for special health care for gay and lesbian people in Norway, especially lesbians, since that's my interest. My best wish would be that any lesbian woman with a health problem would be taken very well care of when she went to seek health care, that her resources would be appreciated, that her life would be taken into consideration as part of problems as well as solutions, and that the doctor would know how not to mess up what he thought of a different lifestyle would affect her health and health problems, but just easily and quickly create a context where she could be the person she is and get the help she needed. In other words, take away the wish for specialist care, which a lot of my American lesbian friends voice very strongly. I interviewed a group of lesbian academics asking for their needs in healthcare, and the only thing they wanted was a lesbian healthcare provider, which in Norway it's not possible, it's not feasible, it's not what we want. I'd rather that my medical colleagues would be sufficiently enlightened to provide excellent care and appreciate the choices of the patient.
Why do you say it's not possible and feasible? Because of how small the population is?
Yes. Well, not only that. I think I know about, less than 20 lesbian Norwegian general practitioners. I would not know all of them, but I would know some of them. So we're few, we're not over spread all over Norway. But second, and that's more important, the Norwegian healthcare system is based on a broad service to everyone. The system is so that the general practitioner should serve everyone, and then you go to specialist care. So the Norwegian GP should be capable of serving any kind of patient. And that's political, that's a choice which has been given both for good use of health services and also for accessibility of services all around Norway. So it's not that I would like to clone hundreds of lesbian doctors and spread them all over Norway, but actually I appreciate our system, and it's not a lack of lesbian doctors in Norway, it's a lack of knowledge on what lesbians need from their doctors.
But I imagine that you recognize that there has been a huge advance within the last 30 years. I mean, in other words, you're going in the right path.
Yeah, certainly. And I'm very happy to see these moves, but I still see we have something left to do.
So what would it what's the biggest challenge? What does it take to get there?
That's for the medical community and the gay lesbian community to be able to balance what's specific and what's general, and how do these match? How can we put these things together? What's specific? What's not specific? What's in which ways are specialist knowledge needed.
Okay.
And that's actually, talking this up, I think that's somehow a queer medical point of view.
Right. So I think I went through my points. Is there something that I missed or out of ignorance of your work or your practice, something that you would like to add or include in this conversation?
I might add just briefly an article, a research article, which was recently published by me and my co-workers in an international journal on methodology and epidemiology, which is about how often does a disease occur and how is it distributed in the population. And in this article we have reviewed most of the studies on lesbian health, not on which diseases are to be prevented, but where are the challenges on research within this area, mm-hmm. such as what is actually a lesbian? Is that a woman who says she's a lesbian? Is it a woman with a positive lesbian test, whatever that would be? Is it a woman who practices sex with other women? Is it a woman who falls in love with other women? Studies are very broadly ranging within this field, which means that a lesbian in one study is not the same as a lesbian in another study. Mm-hmm. And it would be more important for a study on sexually transmitted diseases to know about the sexual practices than the identity of the woman. But perhaps for a study on depression, it would be probably more important to know about attraction and identity. So it depends when is this definition of lesbian important and when is this. However, studies are not comparable because you cannot define the lesbian population. So in this article, we review all these research problems, concluding that especially since most of the prevalence studies, meaning that 55% of lesbians suffer from this disease as compared with 23% of heterosexual women. Most of these studies are not drawn from population samples, representative population samples, which means that you cannot compare at all. So what does this 53% of what? We don't know.
So they're drawn from what exactly?
They are drawn from opportunity samples, from a group of people recruited to this study, maybe because they were especially interested in this problem, to maybe people served by some special clinic. So most of the studies within this field so far are convenience samples from which you can't draw that kind of conclusions at all. So this doesn't mean that you cannot do any research, but it means that you have to be very, very careful about the conclusions you draw. And most of the researchers within this field are not, which creates a problem and also creates an artificial reality of medical facts.